from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Discussions about Israel and Palestine frequently devolve into pitched and heated arguments about how to solve the impasse over territory and borders and whose narrative is more right. Rabbi Michael Lerner has written a new book titled Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. Bishop Tutu calls the book provocative, radical, persuasive, and if given the attention it deserves, could make a major contribution to reconciliation. Rabbi Lerner will join us in studio. We'll also talk with him about Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, which officially begins tonight. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Berkeley-based rabbi and co-founder and editor of Tikkun magazine, Michael Lerner, believes you can be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine. He makes the case in his newest book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. Author of The Politics of Meaning, The Socialism of Fools, Jewish Renewal, Spirit Matters, and with Cornell West Jews and Blacks, he is a recipient of the Martin Luther King Mahatma Gandhi Award, the Penn Oakland Award, and Champion of Forgiveness Award, as well as serving as chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. The Utney Reader named him one of America's 100 most significant visionaries, and he joins us for this morning's opening forum hour. Good to see you again. Welcome.
You too. Thank you.
Well, let's begin. We're going to talk about your book, which is certainly getting some extraordinary kudos from the likes of former President Carter and Desmond Tutu and, Keith Ellison, the only Muslim congressman, and Avram Berg. But I wanted to go right to Hanukkah because it begins tonight. And tell me if I'm wrong in my thinking. I mean, it's a wonderful holiday and it's great for kids and, you know, dreidels and latkes and songs and all that. But it's a minor holiday and it's a military victory that's been made into kind of a rival holiday with Christmas, which I can understand, but seems in some ways almost pretty absurd.
From the standpoint of Jewish law, it's definitely absurd. But from the standpoint of its message, there really is a similar message to Hanukkah in Christmas, and it's a message of liberation. It's a message of the possibility of transformation. It's a message of a light at the end of the tunnel. Here we are in the time of the darkness, so we light the lights. This, of course, predated Hanukkah and Christmas.
It's a festival of lights.
It's a festival of lights, but it's also very much about the possibility of transformation. You see, here Hanukkah celebrates this tiny little group of guerrillas who are able to overthrow the power of the Hellenists in Syria. Well, that's that message that the small, it says it in our liturgy, that's the small triumph over the large, the powerless over the powerful.
David Goliath.
This is a critical message that really is symbolized also by Jesus in the having no place in the inn, right, and being told, okay, here you're amongst the homeless. It's a symbol of the powerless, the poor, the beaten down, being able to actually overcome, transform,
and rise up with militant force, of course.
Rise up with militant force, but the rabbis were confronted with that, and they were unhappy about the way in which it was simply being portrayed as a military victory. And so they insisted on saying, no, this is about God. This is not – and I believe that because God, for me, and I think for much of the Jewish tradition, has historically been the force of transformation and healing in the world, the force that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And in that case, both Hanukkah and Christmas are real symbols of the possibility of overcoming the imperial regimes. And that's something that we need today very much because most people, despairing as they may be about the way that American society and global capitalism have been oppressing people, nevertheless assume that nothing really fundamental can be changed, that we're too small, we're too powerless, that we can't change things.
And so, but does it really equate with Christmas, which means the redemption of the world and salvation and the Messiah and all of those? Because it's been made almost equitable.
Well, you know, Christmas is a beautiful symbol of fundamental transformation in the world. I think Hanukkah can also be that and can be read that way. And it certainly was read that way by the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto when they made such a thing out of Hanukkah as a symbol of hope. Yes, so Hanukkah hasn't been that, but it's being transformed in America in part because of its connection to Christmas in that way. But of course, it's also being transformed, both Hanukkah and Christmas, into orgies of materialism. And that's the downside, that instead of people understanding the spiritual underlying message of both Hanukkah and Christmas, they focus on how much can we buy and how much can we show that we have as much money as the next person and our kids are demanding more and more. So we've gone from a Hanukkah of liberation and a Christmas of liberation to a Hanukkah and Christmas of materialism and selfishness and reinforcing the very values that both Hanukkah and Christmas were struggling against. Because Hanukkah was against material. Hanukkah was against the power of Greece and the Hellenistic culture with its focus on materialism and power. And Jesus was a symbol. Certainly, the birth in that manger was a symbol of resistance to Rome, of saying, no, Roman imperialism should not be the final word about our world.
Well, there are some who haven't forgotten those real meanings of Hanukkah and Christmas.
Exactly.
Talking to Rabbi Michael Lerner, and let's talk about your book, Embracing Israel, Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East, where you say you can be pro-Palestine and pro-Israel. And the main argument in the book, let me see if I can get to the heart of a lot of what I believe you're arguing, and very passionately arguing, as is your wont, that you can change consciousness from this kind of mutual demonizing, that you can change the narratives, that there can be a spiritual reckoning that can bring these two colossal enemies together in some kind of spirit. And it's love and compassion as opposed to, say, military or economic. On the face of it, I must tell you, it seems very naive. And not only naive, but maybe even, I'm thinking as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking about, for example, the rockets that are launched out of the Hamas base Gaza, or I'm thinking about the Israeli settlers who went into that mosque and just ripped it apart, and the settlements that go on. It seems so, the enmity seems so irreconcilable, particularly because of the fanaticism on both sides.
Yes.
That one can despair and does despair.
Absolutely. And the book is meant to show a different path that would make it possible to not despair. But we're living in a world in which it seems as though whatever is happening is so overwhelming that it's hard to imagine a different scenario. This was the case, by the way, over and over again through our history. And that, in fact, that's exactly what Hanukkah is celebrating, is that, you see, in Hanukkah, the vast majority of Jews living in the big cities were already accepting the worldview of the Hellenists, and they wanted to cozy up to the Hellenistic power. And what happened was that a small group of people said, no, we want to transform this consciousness and challenge the assimilation of Jews into Hellenism and reclaim the God of transformation.
Hebraism, as Matthew Arnold might put it, really.
We don't have to go back there. We can go to
our own historical experience. Let's go now.
I think most people, or many people listening to this show, will remember that in the 1960s, when a small, tiny group of women came forward and said, we can challenge patriarchy, everyone said to them, you sound pretty naive. You don't seem to understand that we've had 10,000 years of patriarchy. You can't challenge that. That's ridiculous. Be realistic. Similarly, with regard to the gay and lesbian movement, when they came forward and said, hey, we want real equality of treatment, almost everybody, including people on the left, including people in the women's movement, said, wait a second, we're never going to get anything close to a gay marriage or anything close to that. Similarly, with the civil rights movement, when it began. So over and over and over again, we've seen, and frankly, 8 months ago, people would have said, or a year ago, people would have said, democracy in the Middle East, in Egypt, with its dictator, in Tunisia, with its dictator.
All right, but there's a wonderful example, and forgive me if I'm sounding skeptical, because right now, what we're seeing, I mean, all of the Arab Spring notwithstanding and the hope that was attached to it, we're seeing things move more to the kind of fanaticism. I mean, the recent election showed that the Muslim Brotherhood was overwhelmingly, and even beyond that, the Salafis were given a great deal of a plebiscite or whatever, for lack [S2] Yes. [S1] Of a better word, would be called, certainly strong citizen support. When you see that kind of fanaticism in the Middle East, and I recognize the analogy you make, and they're very heartening to think about with respect to overthrowing patriarchy or overthrowing the sense of homophobia, but we haven't overthrown either of them by a long shot.
No, we've made it incredible.
But the sense of Egypt, for example, is palpable because here was a sense of everything becoming democratized, throwing over the pharaoh once again and all that, and now moving more and more toward fanaticism, it seems.
Look, I'm not here to cheer on the fanatics, okay?
Here to cheer on the spiritual transformation that you believe is plausible.
Well, take a look at the long history, certainly at least close to 100 years, of wild antagonism between France and Germany that led to the First World War, the Second World War, the numbers of people killed on each side, horrendous. And yet today, France and Germany work in concert with each other.
Trying to heal the European Union.
If the European Union could come together, even with all its current economic crises and so forth, but if those two forces that for such a long period hated each other and fought each other and had losses of lives that were far in excess of anything that happened in the Middle East, certainly between Israel and Palestine, you see, transformation is really possible. And it happens over and over again in our lives. But I think most of us have heard two different stories. One story that says we're thrown into this world, we're surrounded by people who want to dominate and control us, and the only way we can survive is to dominate and control others. That's the basis of our foreign policy, and it's the basis of Israeli policy as well at the moment. But there's another worldview that is contending in most people's hearts, and that is the worldview that says, no, we didn't come into this world by ourselves. We came in through our mother, and we had this early experience of loving and caring and kindness and generosity, and from that people have understood and built up the vision of a world based on love and kindness and caring.
Let's take your premise and assume that you're right, that you can shift a strategy of domination, this is your language now, to a strategy of generosity, as you suggest in your book, as you really argue in your book. Where would the first steps begin? I mean, you put aside the military and the borders and all of that. Where would the first steps toward that kind of transformation begin? Don't you need to hit a tipping point?
You absolutely do. And I think that this is where the responsibility is on our shoulders and not just on the shoulders of Israelis and Palestinians. One of the things I argue—
Ours, you mean United States?
Ours being the United States and the people of the United States. See, we have for a very long time been the world's champion of the notion that the way to achieve homeland security is through domination and control. And I don't think that we're going to see the transformation in Israel-Palestine without some transformation in the consciousness of America as well. And that consciousness starts with you and me and everyone else by stopping the discourse that says, hey, the only way to be safe is to dominate and control others, and that's just the realistic path. But instead, and so I, in the book, lay out a global Marshall Plan, and by the way, although I give some of its highlights in the book, you can also find the details of the Global Marshall Plan at our website, spiritualprogressives.org, where we lay out in quite a lot of detail what a Global Marshall Plan could look like. And that Global Marshall Plan should start first in the Middle East. That should be the first place that we try it. But as I also argue in the book, no Global Marshall Plan will work unless it's generated from a spirit of generosity.
You want to change consciousness. I mean, that's really what you're talking about, is a change in consciousness. By the way, when you think about Marshall Plans, one thinks about the tremendous needs in Africa for a Marshall Plan like there was in Europe after the Second World War. But if you're going to have that Global Marshall Plan, as you outline it, and people can read about it in your book and online, the sense is that you really have to marshal a lot of resources, including the heart. And that, and so when people are so afraid of the enemy, when they're so afraid of the other, like you have on both sides of the Middle East, mm-hmm. and you have been, for example, I mean, you've been taken to task by your own people, by your own tribe, for being, you know, talking about this kind of transformation, for being what they see as pro-Palestinian, therefore threatening their security or
yes.
delegitimizing Israel.
Yes, which I certainly don't want to do because I love Israel. But simultaneously, I believe that Judaism has been co-opted into this domination worldview, and I understand why. One of the things I talk about in the book is why we need to develop compassion for both sides, and that doesn't just mean compassion for Palestinians. It also means compassion for Israel, but both peoples have been wildly traumatized through their history, and right now I believe that the best frame to understand each people is through the framework of a post-traumatic stress disorder, and in dealing with the people who are in a situation of post-traumatic stress disorder, coercion doesn't work, but love and generosity can work. Now, where is that going to come from there? Well, what I'm saying is just as you've seen in Israel in the past 20 years, a total transformation around issues about, number one, about sexism, and number two, about heterosexism. When I was working on kibbutz in Israel in the 1960s, the idea that women should be given equal power was thought of as a ludicrous holdover from the socialist ideals of the early Israeli socialist movement that no longer had any application. And if you talked about gays, people would look at my long hair because I had come there from Berkeley, and they'd say, "What are you trying to be a fagala?" There was just no consciousness whatsoever. Now, today, in the course of 20 or 30 years of Western influence, Israel is one of the best societies on issues of gay and lesbian liberation.
But how does that compare to the Arab world, for example? I mean, have you seen similar kinds of movement forward or progress in terms of homophobia or sexism?
Well, you do in the Palestinians, not in the whole Arab world, but there's more understanding of the importance of the role of women. Now, in traditional cultural society, look, you've got in both sides. Look, right now in Israel, there are there's a struggle because the ultra-Orthodox in Israel are refusing to allow women to sit in the front of the bus.
And there you have it, though, Rabbi Lerner. I mean, you have that kind of retrograde sexism not only in Israel but throughout the Middle East and, frankly, throughout the world.
Throughout the world, including the United States.
So we go forward somewhat, we transform on some level, and then you see these backward movements.
Exactly. And it's always how it is. But let me give you another example of transformation. Six months ago, the major focus of all the discourse was how do we cut the deficit? Along come a small group of people and decide to occupy Wall Street. And then hundreds of other cities and towns have local Occupy movements. And all of a sudden, over the course of 2 or 3 months, the public discourse shifts dramatically towards, hey, how do we create jobs? How do we deal with the suffering of people who have been really hurt by the 2008-2009 recession, which now seems to be moving towards a deeper depression? That transformation was totally unpredictable 6 months ago. And if anybody had said that a small group of progressives was going to change the discourse in America and suddenly help people get that there's a class war of the 1% against the 99%, everybody would have said, "Don't be unrealistic, Rabbi Lerner. Don't be. You sound very naive. You think you can change public discourse in that way?" And the answer is yes. The public discourse is shaped by each of us. And one of the things we need to stop is stop saying to each other, "It can't change," because it can change. And that's the message of Hanukkah and Christmas also.
Let me find out how our listeners respond to all this. In fact, let me give out the phone number now. And you are certainly cordially invited to join us with Michael Lerner. Again, his new book is Embracing Israel-Palestine. Some thoughts about Hanukkah or some thoughts about Israel-Palestine. We welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the toll-free number to call. Again, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join the program. 866-733-6786, and we welcome your involvement in the program. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can Join us on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. Kind of ask you, by the way, what was your response to Newt Gingrich saying Palestine is not a historical entity? It does not. The Palestinian people do not exist.
Well, there's this endless competition within each party and between each party about who is going to be the most pro right wing Israelis in the country, and that struggle is somewhat obscene, because the truth of the matter is that those who are lining up, whether it's Gingrich or the other Republicans, are doing the same thing, and frankly, Obama has been doing the same thing.
I agree with you there. They don't go
to the same extreme, but they try to
Obama
play.
Obama kind of froze out Netanyahu, at least early on. Now he seems to be moving more toward that orbit.
But yes,
initially there was a lot of resistance with.
There was a moment of in which Obama seemed to be going in the good direction, and then.
You would call it a good direction. Israelis would disagree with you.
No, not all Israelis. This is my point, is that when you say you're pro-Israel, very often both Republicans and Democrats who say that actually mean they are pro the policies of Israel's most right-wing government that has ever existed. But there are a lot of Israelis, including hundreds of thousands of them who are in the street.
You've got Avram Berg right on the back of your book. I mean, there's a tremendous – there's always been a Peace Now movement in Israel. But
Avram Berg was not just Peace Now. He was also the chair of the Knesset and the interim president
of Israel. He's a major political figure, right.
He's a major political figure, and he says this book is what could possibly lead to a real transformation of consciousness.
But you see, Likud dominates in Israel and the right wing dominates in Israel the same way that now the Muslim Brotherhood has taken a major share of the votes in Egypt. And it seems like in both nations there is this constant movement to the right.
There is no question. You see, it's not that just in both nations, in all of our heads, in every human being on this planet, there is this ongoing struggle between the part of them that believes that we are in danger unless we have domination and control over other people, and the part of us that believes that maybe a world could be based on love and kindness and generosity. And where we are at any given moment, it's partly a response to our childhood experiences, our adult life experiences, the worldviews or ideologies we belong to.
This is a psychologist in you, isn't it?
Well, I am a psychologist as well as a rabbi, yes. But partly it's a response to where the social energy is moving. Because when the social energy seems to be moving towards the right, as it did, for example, in this country in the wake of 2001 and 9/11, then the voices in our heads that have heard that story start to say, yes, these very profound, very realistic, those who believe that only domination and control and wipe out the Muslims, all of that kind of consciousness sounds profound and deep. But and at that moment, when somebody would say to you, you know what, we're going to elect a black man who is a liberal Democrat in 2008.
His middle name is Hussein.
And his middle name is Hussein. They would have said to me or anyone else, hey, you guys are so unrealistic. You are so naive. You are in such a fantasy world. But you see, the thing is that people have both desires inside themselves.
But if your enemy, here's the argument which I'm sure you've heard. The enemy wants to destroy. Al-Qaeda wants to destroy. Therefore, how can we come to them with love and generosity when they want to destroy us? I mean, this is what you hear from both sides in the Middle East conflict.
Exactly. And it's what you hear about the United States. I mean, how can you go with love and generosity to a country that is putting drones in Pakistan and killing civilians and has started a war in Iraq that led to at least a million people dead, although the figures now that they're claiming is only 100,000. And endless casualties, at least 3 million people losing their homes. How can you trust or how can you hope for a country like that? But we here who are on the ground know that most of us aren't warmongers, that most of us don't really want to hurt anybody. We're basically decent people. But from a distance, it looks the opposite. And
you're
the same thing with Israel-Palestine.
Again, the vision of Rabbi Michael Lerner, his new book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. And what do you think about the message you're hearing? And join us. You can join us again on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or by going to our Facebook page or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and Rabbi Michael Lerner is here with us in studio, Berkeley-based author and longtime activist with a new book out called Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He's also the best-selling author of The Left Hand of God. And your congregation is Beit Tikkun, right?
It's in Berkeley.
We're talking about Hanukkah. We're talking about the Middle East. And we're talking with you as well. Let's hear from you. We begin, Jane, with you. Good morning.
Oh, hello.
Yes, hi.
I think that Michael's his idea is very nice. I think it is really utopian. I think, first of all, I think he has an unfortunate choice of vocabulary, using domination and control. I don't think that is a reasonable two words to choose for the whole situation in the Middle East. And I think he has a false assumption that there is an equivalent core of people in both Israel and the Palestinians who are willing, who somehow want to make peace and settle this horribly complicated situation. But I think based on the facts, I don't find any evidence for that. I mean, from 1967, Israel wanted to negotiate to unload that West Bank, and the result was this: all the no's, you know, no negotiation, no recognition. So I think that with the Hezbollah and Hamas and the Palestinians from Gaza, with Michael Krasny mentioned throwing rockets over, I think it's clear that if you look at the evidence, it's like the Israelis may want the wacky extreme Israelis may want Palestinians out. They do not represent the majority of the Israeli people, not in any way.
Well, the polling, excuse me, Jane, because I've studied this. The polling shows that in the Palestinian world of both Gaza and the West Bank and in Israel, the majority of people want peace. Now, what that means, of course, is another matter entirely. But I certainly get your points. And Michael Lerner, you want to respond?
Yes, what I want to say is that if you go there and you start to talk to people, you will find a very different reality than the one that you're reporting. Because on the West Bank and even in Gaza, which, by the way, right now in Gaza, the Palestinian Authority has greater support than Hamas does in terms of the latest polls in the past three,
you know, the truth
three or four
of the matter
weeks.
Is, and I've said this before on the air, I think the only reason that Hamas won that election was because of the corruption of the PLO and,
exactly,
and the anger at the Palestinian Authority.
And the Palestinian Authority has been saying, look, we want to sit down and have a peace negotiation, but we don't want to have it while you're building in Jerusalem and building on the West Bank. We want to freeze in, because what's happening actually is that more and more of the territory is being appropriated by Israel or by Israeli settlers in such a way as to de facto create facts on the ground that will make it impossible to create a two-state solution, or at least that's how the Palestinians understand it. I think it's a mistake to think of either of these peoples in a black and white way. I've seen this in the liberal world or the left world, where people paint Israelis as warmongers, and I've seen it in the conservative world and in some parts of the Jewish world, where they paint Palestinians as either not existing as a country at all or as a people.
But a key question, and yes, you've been asked this, I'm sure, many times: is Hamas not dedicated to the destruction of Israel? Haven't they said, you know, in their articles of confederation, in their articles of essentially statehood and the land that was given to them, that they turn into a sovereign state? We want Israel to be liquidated and we want it destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hamas represents a terrible tendency on the part of people who have come to an extremist view. I remember there were people.
So you're going to change that consciousness, but with love and compassion.
You see, Hamas was a tiny little force 20 years ago. So one asks, well, what made it grow? What made
it possible? Israel helped a great deal. Actually,
Israel helped a great deal,
true.
And the treatment of Palestinians helped a great deal, because after the 1994 Accord, the Oslo Accord, Israel, instead of doing what it had said was going to happen, namely withdraw from the West Bank, by 2000, it had tripled the number of settlers on the West Bank. So the Palestinians, looking at the facts on the ground, were saying, hey, what happened to this agreement? You were going to get out of here and let us live in peace with you, and now you're doing the opposite. And then you're using Hamas as your excuse and saying, yes, we know Hamas, but it can be marginalized. So the point is that, yes, the core of Hamas is terrible. terrible. Just as the core of the settler movement is very, very destructive and seeks to eliminate Palestinians in the West Bank, wants to push them into. But that doesn't mean that the majority of people are stuck there. They, in fact, change their consciousness and would change their consciousness again, just as happened, by the way, when Sadat came to Jerusalem. The polls the week before Sadat came to Jerusalem said 80% of the Israeli public was opposed to giving back any land and any deal with Sadat. A week after his visit in 1978, 80% of the people were in favor of giving back the
and
land.
And Sadat was probably assassinated by the Muslim Brotherhood,
exactly,
who are now coming into
but
power
what
in Egypt
I'm
once
to
again.
You is that where people are can be changed by a different consciousness, and that people's consciousness there, like here, like everywhere, switches because most people have both voices in their head, the domination voice and the love voice. And what we need is to stop reinforcing the picture of people as stuck in the domination view and start helping people to realize that the love, generosity consciousness, which, by the way, has been part of both Islam and Judaism and Christianity, of course, for a very, very long time, that those voices can be supported.
But I want to support more voices. We got a lot of callers. Let's go to as many of them as we can. I just read an email here. It says the main thing sustaining the demand for a Palestinian state is pressure by the oil-rich leaders of the Arab nations who don't want the Palestinian Arabs in their borders, don't want to provide financial help to these people, and fear Israel's democratic philosophy and its technological progress could spark an Arab revolt like the one in Egypt and Libya. We'll go to more of your calls. Colin joins us. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning. Rabbi, when Netanyahu made a speech to the U.S. Congress earlier this year, he received a standing ovation, even though he essentially stated that he was not going to give up any of the lands that Israel had taken in 1967 as part of the peace process. We give over $3 billion in economic and military aid each year to Israel. Is that aid really counterproductive? Isn't it simply enabling the intransigence of the Likud government in refusing to negotiate seriously with the Palestinian Authority?
Well, yes, I do think that Netanyahu and the right-wing forces he represents have to be publicly challenged by the people of the United States, and we have to tell our elected leaders from Obama down to every congressperson not to support that. But that doesn't mean that the $3 billion, really it's a paltry amount. The problem with Israel and its stuckness will be just as strong if there were no such $3 billion as it is
now. If you're going to turn American citizens against Israel, or at least make them more critical of Israel and supporting, I mean, Israel in the present avatar of the Netanyahu government, you're going to have to change a lot of people's beliefs, because the evangelicals particularly are as fanatically pro-Israel as many of the Zionists.
And they
maybe
represent
more.
The evangelicals represent the core of the Israel lobby, and that's why it's so powerful. Yes, we do have to change a lot of people's ideas. And the first thing we have to do is to stop allowing
change
people
their beliefs,
to say,
though. You're changing their beliefs, aren't you? They believe that Israel exists in order for the rapture to take place. And so.
But they don't necessarily have to believe that the best way to support Israel. You see, this is the key, that people who want to support Israel, and I'm one of them, and so are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other American Jews, understand that the best way to support Israel is to be pro-peace and reconciliation between Israel and Palestine, and that the supporting of the right-wing governments in Israel actually is destructive. It's anti-Israel. It works against Israel's survival. And if I were a real anti-Semite, I'd be supporting Netanyahu, because his policies are generating hatred of Jews all around the world. And Israel's survival depends on reconciliation with Palestine. And so the two sides there, to be pro-Israel, you have to be pro-Palestine. To be pro-Palestine, you have to be pro-Israel. That's why I'm not in favor of going with the direction of, let's cut off aid, because that only is a symbolic gesture that only reinforces Israelis' fears that we're all alone in the world and that the world is against us and therefore we can't make any compromises. We need a very different kind of approach, and in the details of which I've laid out in this book, the
we'll go to more
Embracing
calls.
Israel-Palestine.
Olivia joins us next. Olivia, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Rabbi. This is a great show. Thank you so much, Michael, both Michaels, for having it. I actually wanted to hear your views about the Occupy movement and if you feel like it represents this change in consciousness or not.
Mm. Well, you've said it's transformative. You see it as transformative.
I see it as transformative. I see it as also having made some serious mistakes. I don't think that the Occupy movement – I think the Occupy movement would be better to reframe itself as the movement for the 99% and to not focus solely on liberating some particular space. I also think that in Oakland, there's a core of people there who are refuse to embrace nonviolence, and I think the Occupy movement should distance from them. But I think fundamentally, the Occupy movement is a liberation movement that needs to be supported and extended to the other. A large number of people who support the goals of the Occupy movement can't really be part of sitting in and some of the other things that they're doing, and it can't really feel comfortable as long as the movement doesn't officially dissociate itself from violence. So go for the Occupy movement, but let's try to create a broader frame in which we can bring into a movement the 99%, many of whom can't connect to the specifics of the Occupy movement, can't go to a meetings at every night at 6 or 7 o'clock at night, can't abide by a process that has no explicit goals and no strategy. We need to take – the adults need to take over now with Occupy. So many of our listeners, I think, on this show and in people who read Tikkun magazine, which I edit, so many of our people want to support the struggle of the 99%, but don't have a form to do it. And I think it's time for us to get together and create a different kind of gathering, a much more democratic gathering in which you have 50% of the vote wins, not 80%, not consensus, but the Occupy movement, though, is very much like the early Christian movement and very much like the early early Maccabees.
Let me go to some emails here before I go to more of your calls. Here's Dan from Berkeley who says, shortly after the murder of journalist Daniel Pearl in Pakistan, Rabbi Lerner appeared at a forum at UC Berkeley Department of Journalism and infuriated Pearl's Wall Street Journal colleagues by blaming the U.S. press as being instrumental in Pearl's assassination. Does Rabbi Lerner still believe this, and could he elaborate on his contention? And this same listener writes, in 1997, Michael Lerner's own staff outed him for writing under pseudonyms, fawning letters praising him in Tikkun magazine. Given this, how can Lerner believe anyone speaks and writes with any semblance of veracity?
Okay, this is the personal attack kind of thing. Look, as far as Daniel Pearl goes, I believe that he would not have been killed if there hadn't been a war that the United States had generated in the Middle East, and that climate.
Wait, which war in Afghanistan the United States generated? Because they were giving. I don't want to get back to the roots of the Afghanistan war, but they were giving essentially sanctuary to the Taliban, and the Taliban was allied with Al Qaeda, and we were hit.
The United States was involved under the Bush regime in a huge assault on Muslims and on the Muslim culture, and Wall Street Journal, for which Pearl worked, was a champion for more wars and more domination in the Middle East. And I in no way sympathize with anybody doing what they did. I thought it was outrageous and awful. And
those are mild words for beheading someone, if I may say so.
Disgusting and murderous and et cetera. Okay. So I had no sympathy for that, but understand the climate. I'm not, and certainly not trying to understand those crazy people who did it.
Crazy people who did it are the people you want to transform, that you claim love in their hearts.
No, I want to take their support away. You see, it's very different. I don't think that the extreme crazies, either in Israel or in Palestine, are ever going to be transformed, at least not in my lifetime. But What I do think is possible is that their base can be moved away from them, just as the base that supported the war in Iraq in the early part of the 21st century moved away from those who wanted war as our response. As to the other charge, this thing about creating letters, I never created a letter praising myself or the editorials in Tikkun.
Wikipedia says that there were letters, including negative letters, that you admitted were fabricated, but you said your only mistake was not informing readers that the authors' names were pseudonyms. That's right from Wikipedia.
Wikipedia
is an invincible source.
Anybody can write something in Wikipedia, right? I mean,
I
could write that Michael Krasny was the Messiah, and until somebody came to cross it out, maybe you are. But anyway,
isn't there a Talmudic interpretation that we all have Messiah in us? I think we can go to that. I'm sorry, that was your response. It was on Wikipedia as your response. I want to get that straight. It was in Wikipedia, but that was your response. At least it was quoted. Do you have a response now to that? I mean, were there letters that were fabricated?
Yeah, here's what we – yes, there were. What we did was we created letters to critique articles based on conversations we had with people in who were our readers who would tell us their critiques but not – be willing to put their name to it. So we said, okay, look, we're getting too many letters that are positive. Let's create some letters that are negative so that we can have a more robust discussion of the articles. And so we took what people were telling us. We wrote it. We asked them for permission to use their name. And when they didn't give the permission, but they said this is what they believe, then we created a name for them. I think that was a mistake. We shouldn't have done that. But never created anything positive about us because that was just the opposite of what we wanted. We wanted to have more debate, not more praise.
And we'll go to more calls. And Aaron, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick comments. First, given the historical oppression of Jews in the United States, I'm somewhat surprised. I'm a big fan of yours, Dr. Krasny, but I'm surprised you're having a challenge in seeing the possibilities of Rabbi Lerner's radical thoughts. As a Jew, Jewish American who knows the history of oppression of Jews in this country, to add a piece to that, I sit in the endowed Swig Chair of Judaic Studies at the University of San Francisco, a Jesuit Catholic school, the first in the country to create this space some 30 years ago. And if we look at Catholic-Jewish relations historically, you know, some people in my family thought it was crazy for me to even have taken this job. But, you know, we're in the 21st century now. Things have changed. There are possibilities for transformation. The second quick point is I'd like to introduce the language of an important NGO out there called Abraham's Vision, the language of de-exceptionalization. Just as Rabbi Lerner is bringing in the changes of other movements, such as gender rights, sexual orientation rights, and looking at those changes over the course of time, we need to look at Israel-Palestine in terms of other contemporary conflicts. Israelis and Palestinians have not been at war with one another for centuries. It's a modern struggle akin to Northern Ireland, South Africa, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Rwanda, and even though there's differences between these conflicts, we also need to de-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine and look at, yeah, it's going to change. Something's going to happen. There are going to be, at a minimum, two states. There's going to be shifts.
Hey,
thank you.
I thank you for that.
It's a beautiful statement.
Nice positive note, and certainly welcome here. Here's Tim from Berkeley who writes, what about a single cosmopolitan state with protections of religious freedom? Everyone in Israel-Palestine would be citizens. Then Israel could really live up to its claims of modern diversity. It seems to me that if the blood of the 10 lost tribes is in anyone, it's in the people who have lived in the area the longest, the Palestinians. I don't know if Israel would be accepted as a name for this state, but such a state would be a model of unity and even historicity in the world. Well, it's funny because whenever the one-state solution comes up, it is dismissed out of hand pretty much by even the most progressive thinkers, at least I've discovered from doing the show for many years. And you do not dismiss it out of hand, or you do?
In the short run, I think that Jews today are still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And to try to ask them to give up the one protection that they feel they have, namely an army and a national entity for themselves, is a non-starter. I think the same thing is true for most Palestinians. I don't think most Palestinians.
Do you think Jews are suffering from PTSD because of living in Israel under constant
because
of the Holocaust?
Because of not just the Holocaust, 2,000 years of being treated as other, then the Holocaust, and then the unfair treatment of Israel in its early days by Arab states surrounding it, and then by the continuing element of terrorism.
When does that begin to change? Because you could say, by the same token, I suppose that African Americans, because of slavery, have PTSD.
I think you would. I certainly would. And
even though we were removed by 4 or 5 generations,
and hence, I understand why the solution to the problems facing African Americans in this country is not more police, but more generosity toward that community. And I think a growing number of people in this world who aren't racist can now understand that the best way to end the high level of crime in African American communities is to to increase generosity, to increase the well-being of those communities, not to increase repression and domination.
Have you read the book by Zimmering? You know, Professor Zimmering from the Law School of Berkeley. Frank Zimmering?
No, actually, I haven't read that book.
Well, it's actually why New York crime has increased so dramatically. We had him on the program, and he said, more police, essentially, more police. He backs it up empirically.
The more police, the more repression, the more crime.
But actually, he makes a case that there's less crime because of more police.
I think
read the book.
That's a tough one. All right.
It is a tough one. Let's get to some more callers.
Yes,
we'll go to Rachel. Rachel, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Great. I'm a Bay Area Jew, and I actually worked for a human rights org in Israel for 6 months. But I don't consider myself to be a supporter of Michael Lerner. However, I do think what he's saying is that, you know, we've tried the stick, so why not try the carrot? And I completely agree. And, you know, my comment is basically just why not? Why not try what he's saying? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Can I say one thing, by the way?
That's what you're saying. Why not try it? I mean, everything else has failed, so.
Exactly, and that's for the United States as well. We've tried domination. Let's try generosity, and hence the Global Marshall Plan. But I do want to say that what I'm representing is not to be supporters of Michael Lerner. I could care less whether anybody wants to be a supporter of Michael Lerner. We do have a movement called the Network of Spiritual Progressives, which, by the way, includes people who are atheists and agnostics, but who are also spiritual. And by spiritual, we mean that in replacing the bottom line of money and power with a new bottom line of love, caring, kindness, and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, and awe and wonder at the grandeur of the universe.
Here's a listener, Malcolm, who says, in today's New York Times, there is an article comparing conciliatory Palestinian leadership statements in English toward the West versus the hardline anti-Israel statements these same leaders made in their language to their own people. The same thing's happening in China with anti-American movies and statements. How can we change this parochial behavior, which appears to me to be nearly worldwide?
It's true. It is nearly worldwide by leaders who are opportunists. How do we change that? By getting leaders who aren't opportunists, by getting leaders who are willing unequivocally to support love, kindness, and generosity. Don't underestimate the power of love, kindness, and generosity. This is the key message of Judaism. It's been the key message of Christianity. The core of going to the world with a loving heart and with a generous approach will unfreeze the frozenness. But it's going to take it's going to take some time to go there. But this is why I'm a religious person. This is why, as a rabbi, Beit Tikkun, our synagogue in Berkeley, embodies this and articulates this. Don't write off the spiritual wisdom of the human race, because that spiritual wisdom has been with us for thousands of years. It hasn't been tried. It's time to try it now. You've tried domination and control. You've tried power over. Let's try love, generosity, kindness, open-heartedness, reconciliation, and willingness to acknowledge our own errors and sins.
This is your midrash. I get it. I understand it. We're going to get some more calls on here. We'll go to a caller named Bartleby, I'm sorry?
Yes, it's Bartleby.
Hello. Like Bartleby the Scrivener, really?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So just to follow up on the single state theory, if Israel is actually an apartheid state, really, I think you really need to consider the possibility of a single multicultural state for Israel and Palestine. I mean, ultimately, that's the only solution and the only form of peace and justice that we can ever have.
Well, in the short run, I think that it's a non-starter, and I want to end the oppression of Palestinians as quickly as possible, and that's by having their having them have their own state, and I want to end the suffering of the Israeli people by having reconciliation with the Palestinians, and the Palestinian state is the short run way to do that. In the long run, I don't support a one-state solution because, and if you were dismissing me before for being unrealistic, listen to this one, I support a no-state solution. That is to say, I believe that in the 21st century, the smartest way for people to deal with the problem, the fundamental problem we're facing, which is the problem of the environment and the destruction of the environment from 150 years worth of irresponsible behavior on the part of capitalist and socialist societies, or at least so-called socialist societies. They really weren't.
It was actually the socialist society that wanted ultimately, according to Marx, to do away with the state. That was the dream.
I'm in favor. I believe that we need to overcome. We've had 250 years of rampant nationalism, and it has been the cover for a huge destruction of our planet. We now need to reconfigure our global political arrangements in such a way that we overcome the national entities and build ecological districts around the globe. And I think that this idea, which sounds crazy in 2011, by 2060 and 2070 will sound very, very plausible. So the short run, two states. The long run, no states. Let's overcome this crazy nationalism that diverts our attention from the real problem facing the human race, namely the destruction of the environment of our planet.
And here's a listener, Mariam, who says, I studied at the American University of Cairo in the 1990s, and the sense I got from people was that liberalism and Westernism was strongly associated with the corrupt governments in the Middle East that the U.S. and other Western powers supported. Whether or not they liked the Muslim Brotherhood or similar parties, people thought that they were looking out for their own people, whereas there was suspicion that liberal groups were there to voice the interests of other countries. Given this history, I'm not at all surprised that the Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood are so popular in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Very important point. Because it means that instead of thinking that the reason why they're popular is simply because they hate or that they want to destroy Israel, look at what's going on concretely. They didn't run in the election where the fundamentalists won in Israel, in Palestine, the last election. It wasn't because they were running on let's destroy Israel. They were running on let's end corruption. Let's create a society in which there's more caring. And the fundamentalists have done that caring. So understand that when the bad guys get support, it's not for their bad guyness. It's often for decent things that they've done on the side.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, we're out of time. Thank you for being with us. The book again, Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. Good to have you on Forum. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Next hour, we're going to have John Kabat-Zinn with us. We're going to talk about meditation and mindfulness. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.